Hello, everybody. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ, and you are listening to another episode of the Midnight Mass podcast. We have an exciting, special idol worship episode for you today. But before we introduce our subject of worship, I'd like to introduce my fantastic co-host, filmmaker, friend, collaborator. It's Michael Verratti.
Yay. Oh, Peaches, I am so glad to be doing this week in worship of this filmmaker that we're about to talk about, because what a great subject to kick off our first idol worship episode.
And maybe we should explain that idol worship as a title actually is born out of the Midnight Mass stage show, and it was the title we gave to the show we did with Mink Stole the first time she came to Midnight Mass. She was the first celebrity ever to come, and we had a big banner on stage that said "Hail Mink," and we had an effigy of Peggy Gravel, a robot that we built that was stirring rabies, a vat of rabies with dry ice and stuff on stage. And so Mink was the first patron saint to come and be worshipped in person, you know, at the altar of Peaches. And from there, I mean, my God, I'm really, really lucky. I've had so many incredible people come and sometimes do multiple shows with me, such as John Waters or Tura Satana, Elvira, Apollonia, Pam Grier, Bruce Campbell, in the list. I mean, luckily, I can honestly say the list of people I've been able to celebrate in person is just incredible. Now, tonight, because we're doing today or this morning, depending on when you're listening to this, because we are doing the podcast version, Michael and I have decided that idol worship can take on a new meaning, which means that the subject of our worship may not even be alive anymore. They may actually be a ghost, someone who has declared that they are, in fact, a ghost, you know, in the afterlife. And so, Michael, why don't you introduce our fantastic ghost, the subject of our special idol worship episode?
Well, it is my absolute honor. You know, I love that you said that idol worship is about the patron saints of Midnight Mass, because in terms of the podcast, I can't think of a better patron saint at this point in our run to honor, because in many ways, a lot of the filmmakers that we have, you know, paid homage to and the movies we've paid homage to up to this point have all used this particular person as a reference. And without further ado, I have to say, we're taking out life insurance policies this week because we're feeling a certain tingle to celebrate the amazing filmmaker behind such genre classics as Homicidal, The House on Haunted Hill, The Tingler, 13 Ghosts, Mr. Sardonicus, Let's Kill Uncle, and so many more. Of course, it is the showman himself, the legendary William Castle.
Yay! Oh my God. I know you and I and our guests today all share a true and deep love for William Castle and just the entire world that William Castle created. And as we'll discuss with our guests, I mean, I think you and I actually even got a deeper understanding through our conversations of why we love William Castle so much. I mean, clearly, William Castle's gimmicks, which he's famous for. And for those of you who don't know much about William Castle, maybe Michael and I can kind of fill you in, because our conversations might assume that you know a certain amount. But William Castle was a filmmaker who made, I don't know, what is it, like 67 movies, something like that, 67 yeah. features, which is just an insanely prolific amount of filmmaking to do. But what he was really famous for, in addition to making horror movies and spooky movies and fun movies, was his marketing and really using gimmicks to sell these movies and put butts in seats. And so he had all sorts of different kinds of gimmicks that were wrapped up into the marketing of these films, including most famously probably quote unquote, electrifying the seats of the audience for the tingler, so that when the monster, the creature from the film, actually crawled out from the screen and into the audience, and Vincent Price is basically pointing from the screen saying that there's the tingler, and the only way to kill the tingler is to scream, you know, and you killed the tingler with scream. You know, a switch was thrown in the actual movie theater, and these seats were connected to, I guess they were these motors or something that vibrated against the metal and shook the seat, made it feel like, you know, the vibration was so intense, it made it feel like an electric jolt. And of course, the audience just freaked out. Now, I know the carny, haunted house loving kid in me, as soon as I heard that this had been done, you know, as a teenager reading the book Shock Value by John Waters and reading about the Tingler, I was obsessed. You know, I could not believe, you know, that something like this had happened. And Michael, you could probably explain a few of the other gimmicks, and we don't have time to explain all of them because there are really truly that many.
No, it's true. William Castle really had a flair for showmanship that ended up informing a whole generation of filmmakers that followed. And I referenced a few of his tricks in my intro, including the life insurance policy. He did a movie where he went to Lloyd's of London and took out life insurance policies for anyone who was scared to death while watching the movie. I believe it was during House on Haunted Hill, he sent a skeleton flying through the audience on a pulley system. Yes. In Mr. Sardonicus, there was the option of voting for whether the lead character lived or died at the end, and there's still kind of a question if this other ending even exists or if that was just part of the trick.
Of course it doesn't.
Well, I mean, when you think about the effort it would take to change the reel, that in of itself is something.
I love that there's even a question about whether or not the other ending exists, because, you know, I think he was brilliant and he knew that the audience would never vote the other way, right? So that's hilarious.
Right. But, you know, I think it's just a testament to William Castle's understanding of not only genre fans and horror fans, but what people want out of their cinema going experience. He was a filmmaker who knew that if you love movies, you want to live inside the movie. You want to live inside that dream and that experience. And he is a showman, as a filmmaker, as this sort of great carnival barker for 90 minutes made it possible, where a lot of other filmmakers, you know, could only dream of that. And it's really great to see that his legacy has continued on. I mean, if you look back even at the course of Midnight Mass episodes that we've done, John Waters, who we celebrated when we did Desperate Living, has cited William Castle as his favorite filmmaker. Of course, when we did Death Becomes Her, Robert Zemeckis is a huge fan of William Castle. What Peaches herself does with the original Midnight Mass and what she has done with all of her stage shows is very much in the vein of William Castle. So it makes sense that we would be worshiping at his altar today, because a lot, if not everything we do, would not exist without him.
It's so true. One thing that we did not talk about in our conversations with our special guests is the fact that William Castle has such a great name. Like,
yes.
Just the name alone, right? Now, I know it's not the name he was born with. He was an orphan, and he was adopted. And in many ways, he had sort of a challenging childhood when you read about, you know, his childhood. But what I love is he was always attracted to marketing. He chose that name smartly, and he understood marketing, and he understood people. He understood the audience. You know, in many ways, and as we will explore, there's this sort of upsetting reality to our love of William Castle, which is that his peers, his contemporaries, never gave him the validation he deserved, and he never got to live long enough to see how much his legacy would be important and just huge. And, you know, I think that is a really tragic part of his story, because he just was so unique. And one of the things I think is unfortunate in the world of art, and whether it's theater or filmmaking, there is this sense that putting yourself in the audience's shoes is cheap or it's not artistic, right? To think about entertainment and to think about the audience is actually not being an artist. And I think that's such a short-sighted way to look at stuff. And I look at someone like William Castle or Herschel Gordon Lewis, some of these filmmakers who really were going, what did the audience want? And you go back and you watch those films, they hold up. You know, those movies, this guy was telling a great story. He was adding gimmicks that were dismissed as cheap that now people wish they could actually pull off. You know, he was so ahead of his time in many ways. And it's just so frustrating to think that obviously we know that the director he was most compared to was Hitchcock, right? He was often called the poor man's Hitchcock or something along those lines. But the reality of it is, and you make a great point, you know, in one of our conversations, is that without William Castle, there wouldn't be Psycho, which I'll allow Michael to explain. But on the flip side, it's okay to like both. It is okay. Yeah. It is okay to love Alfred Hitchcock and to love William Castle for what William Castle did and to love Brian De Palma or anyone else who's, you know, inspired by Alfred Hitchcock.
Right. And what I think is really important about this particular episode and the conversations that we have is that it's really all about legacy, because what he felt like he wasn't able to achieve while he was alive, he in fact achieved in spades and influenced a whole generation of filmmakers and film goers. And, you know, everything that we've talked about through the course of almost all of the episodes we've done up to this point, feel his touch. And so, you know, when it comes to the world of cult films, you can't deny the legacy of William Castle. And I feel like that's a great segue into our first set of guests, because no one understands the legacy of William Castle more than the people we're about to talk to. And that's his daughter, Terry Castle, the amazing producer, and his grandson, Kyle Newell, who is a filmmaker in his own right. And they're about to join us and talk all about their father and grandfather's legacy.
So special. Okay, enjoy this. Well, hello, everybody. Oh, my goodness. I am so excited because, our guests today are descendants of cult film royalty. Okay, so this is a real honor, a total privilege. One of my ultimate idols has to be William Castle, and we have his daughter with us today, Terry Castle, and his grandson, Kyle Newell, who are here on the podcast. Welcome, Terry and Kyle.
Thank you so much, Peaches. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. We're delighted to be here, and we're royalty. Oh my God, I need my tiara.
You absolutely are royalty. And I mean, I, as you may know, have produced a series called Midnight Mass over the years in San Francisco. And your father and grandfather were perhaps my biggest inspiration, or up there with, you know, my inspirations like John Waters and Elvira. Because one of the things we did with Midnight Mass in particular that is a direct relation to your father were the gimmicks that we created around our pre-show celebrations and celebrations of cult movies. And of course, the inspiration for these gimmicks came from William Castle. So if you ever wondered where I decided it would be a good idea to offer free lap dances with every large popcorn at our showgirl screenings, it's directly connected to my knowledge of William Castle. I don't know if he'd approve of that. I think
he'd probably be so proud.
Oh, good. And then, of course, we've shown William Castle films. So it is a total honor to have you both here. Welcome to the podcast. I guess my first question is, what was it like growing up with this extraordinary showman as your, you know, father and your grandfather?
As my daddy?
Yeah. as your daddy.
He was the best father in the universe. He was charismatic. He was nice. He was compassionate. He cared about everybody. He was, I always have to start with this because here is this, you know, horror, you know, sort of legend, you know, and like who, he was like the nicest person in the world. So I always have to start with that because he was the best dad ever. But it was really fun growing up with Dad. It was never dull. He always had a cigar. He always had a book or a story. He would ask my friends to come over and listen to horror stories. They've never been the same since. They were like eight.
Wow.
So let me tell you about this mass murderer with this giant axe. You know, I was supposed to be in one of his films, and I had to rehearse with him for weeks. I was supposed to be in Straight Jacket.
Wow.
And I was supposed to, yes, with Joan Crawford. Mm. And I was supposed to watch Joan Crawford. I was supposed to be her daughter. I was supposed to play, her daughter when she was young. And I was supposed to walk in as my mother, Joan, was, you know, hacking off the head of her lover.
Oh.
That was 5-year-old me. So yeah, it was fun.
So you were playing like young Diane Baker. Yeah.
Because I kind of looked like her when I was little. And uh-huh. Pictures of her when she was young. And of course, I wanted to be an actress when I was 5. And then I got on the set and it was freezing ass cold. Because Joan wanted it, you know, I kind of need it right now. She wanted her skin to be really taut. Mm. She wanted to look, you know, young. And she was scary. There was something terrifying about her.
Uh-huh.
And she had me come and sit on her lap. And I looked at my dad and I said, I'm out of here. That was it. That was my big movie debut.
Oh, that is so great. I love that.
Well, you know, when Peaches was giving her intro, she talked about the influence that William Castle had on Midnight Mass and bringing the gimmicks to the shows that Peaches does, and that level of showmanship that is so part of the William Castle brand. And when you consider that legacy, not only is Peaches speaking about influence, but we know John Waters has referenced William Castle as his favorite filmmaker. Robert Zemeckis, we just did Death Becomes Her last week. And Robert Zemeckis has spoken often about William Castle. And when you grow up in a household, you tend to not immediately zero in on what your parents is doing as being unusual because that's the life that you live, right? But at what point when you were out in the world did you realize, oh, my grandfather made this lasting impact that has affected pop culture? Have you ever had these moments where you're just out there and realize?
Yeah, I think I can jump in and answer this one quickly. So I think I was about 8 or 9 years old. We were at a Monster Palooza mom had taken me to. And the one thing I want to say about everybody who likes Grandpa's movies and are fans of his is everybody is the sweetest, nicest people I've ever met in my entire life. He has the best fans in the world, and I will stick by that. This one Monster Palooza, I was standing next to Mom. She was chatting with a few of fans. I think I was 8 or 9, and this gentleman walked up to me. And he said he was a really big fan of my grandfather's. He was an artist, and he wanted to give me some trading cards that he had made of some of the leading ladies that had started my grandfather's movies. And so I took the cards, and I said, you know, thank you so much. This is so awesome. I'm 8 years old. I love baseball cards. And I start to take a look, and I notice that the hand drawings, they're all nude, all of the women. Joan Crawford is nude. Everybody is naked.
Wow.
And I was like, this is wild. Mom, here are these cards I'm not supposed to have. So I have them, you know, in my desk right now, you know, sitting there. So perfect. But I think that was the first time I really realized, you know, oh man, this is a little bit different, you know, than some of the other kids that I'm growing up with.
Yeah. My grandpa's work never got me nude trading cards. So.
Well, and
I couldn't get them away from him.
Oh, you couldn't get them away from Kyle once he had them?
No.
Oh,
no.
That's so good.
Growing up in my family, it was not weird at all. I didn't know anything that was weird. It just felt like this is how it all happened. I mean, it was just, you know, I probably should have thought it was weird because my dad was such a family guy, and all he wanted to do was be with my mom and his girls. And like, we would get invited, he'd get invited to dinner with, you know, anybody, like, you name it, you know, Vincent Price, and he'd be like, I have to bring my girls. So like, we would always go like to like Vincent Price's house for turtle soup. It's like, okay, that's weird, but okay. But it wasn't weird. And I think, I mean, it was John Waters who sort of brought him back from the dead, and rewrite, you know, he just, I mean, I just owe everything to John for continuing Dad's fantastic legacy. And, you know, the hard part for me is that Dad died thinking he wasn't successful. So all this would just blow him away. It would just blow him away because he was relegated to B movies, and he, you know, it's a hard world, and he didn't realize how much fun and how many people actually loved his films. I mean, there's a whole generation of monster kids that like Bob Zemeckis who loved Dad. He was like their favorite uncle, and you know, and I understand it because that's how he. I mean, it comes over. He has a wink and a smile, and that was Dad, and people loved it, and that generation got it. So, but I was, you know, I was so young, I didn't, and then, you know, he went away, and then the whole industry changed, and the horror films changed, and it became so different, and it took a while for people to, like, refine him, and then say, oh my God, he's really fun. Right. His films might not be the best, but it's the best experience.
Well, absolutely. I'm a great example of the person who discovered your father through the film school of John Waters. I often say, like, right. John Waters, for many of us, was our film school. Like, I went to film school. I went to Penn State. I studied film. I made a movie. But it was reading Shock Value and learning about Herschel Gordon Lewis, about, you know, William Castle, Russ Meyer, Doris Wishman, Ted V. Michaels. And in this sort of the knowledge that these filmmakers had inspired John led so many of us Waters fanatics to find your father. And when I discovered his films, it was like candy. And the way that you describe fans' relationship to him is so true for me, because we used to get the 35 millimeter trailers of his films when we would run them, and he's often in the trailers, right? So I would run these trailers at the Bridge Theater where we originally did Midnight Mass. And there was something so wonderfully warm about his presence on screen, right? Like, he definitely was doing the Hitchcock thing where he was taking you through the story and he's the filmmaker and he's the showman. But unlike Hitchcock, who's a little bit creepy and weird, you know, William Castle, I mean, well, let's face it, you know, like, you don't feel the sort of the cozy warmth, you know, when Hitchcock is talking to you. But with your dad,
especially if you're a woman, never mind.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
true.
Right? You know. But with your father, it just felt like he was like this sort of almost idealistic, like Norman Rockwell, you know, dad. Like, I guess I love hearing from you that he is that he really was this wonderful man. And I also love that you start the show by saying that he was this wonderful person because horror is so misunderstood. I do think that now we have a better understanding of horror fans because horror's become so popular. But for a long time, I mean, certainly in the 80s, as a kid going to Catholic school and subscribing to Fangoria magazine, you know, I had nuns and priests contacting my parents saying there was something wrong with me. And, you know, there was a stigma attached to this. And what we now know is that a lot of people who love horror are actually the most deeply empathetic, sensitive people. And horror is sort of this way to, you know, exercise our inability to deal with the horrors of the real world.
Exactly. That's it.
Yeah, it makes total sense. So, okay, I think we have to ask some obvious questions. I want to ask each of you, what is your favorite film of William Castle's?
Kyle, you go ahead.
I think my favorite would have to be, oh man, I really, I love Homicidal. And I love Straitjacket. Those to me are my top two. I love watching Joan Crawford in Straitjacket. I think seeing Lee Majors in his first role is really fun and really exciting. Those are the two that I find myself, you know, watching with friends and, you know, coming back to. Those would be my top two. And if anybody hasn't had the chance to check those out yet, I would certainly recommend them.
I'm a tingler girl. I mean, how much better can you get than seeing Vincent Price drop out LSD? I mean, that says it all, right? I mean, it was to me, that was just the perfect, brilliant, can't scream, there's a tingler in your body, get out of the theater, everybody's screaming, there's buzzers going on, off on your butts. I mean, everything is in that film.
Yes. Good answer. And Michael, what's your favorite?
Well, I have to say The House on Haunted Hill, because you talk about grand Vincent Price performances. That movie, he truly delivers. But also, as listeners of the show know, Peaches and I both appreciate drag as an art form, but as a state of being as well. And there's nothing more high drag than Vincent Price and his wife alone exchanging barbs about their attempts at killing each other that I just warms my heart very deeply.
That conversation between the two of them is brilliant. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so well written.
So truly good. Well, I have to say, it's gonna seem like I'm a total copycat, because my answer is actually the same as Kyle's. I think probably I would say Straight Jacket. If like a gun was put to my head and they said you have to pick one William Castle movie, it would be Straight Jacket. But Homicidal is such a close second, just by virtue of the fact that it's so bizarre. Of course, I love all the gender issues it brings up. Spoiler alert, but you know, both those films were popular films that we did at Midnight Mass. And actually, with Homicidal, we passed out. We made our own William Castle gimmick, because I tried to enhance, you know, the screening experience. So we passed out something I made up called Helga Knockers, where I went and got these blocks, like kids' blocks, and we created a stencil that said Helga Knocker. And the audience all knocked their, armrests. And it was fabulous, you know.
Oh, my God, that's brilliant. Amazing. Dad should have thought of that. Oh, my God. You need to go meet Dad, but not for another 100 years. But that's brilliant. Yes.
When we finally do meet, I'm going to tell him. And then, of course, when we made the poster, we insinuated Helga Knockers might be something else, like a part of her anatomy, you know. So it was...
Such great knockers you have.
Yeah, exactly. So lots of those kinds of jokes. And we did Straight Jacket. I had the poor staff of the Bridge Theater create a stencil and take all the cardboard we had, and we made little axes and passed out the axes, you know, as the audience came in.
Weren't real?
No, they weren't real axes, but we did do. And Straight Jacket we actually did a number of times. And I did get to meet Diane Baker once, which was really interesting.
She's
because she's really, really sweet and really lovely. And I really tried to talk her into, like, maybe, you know, coming and doing the show. And I think she would have a lot to say, you know, is my sense. But it just never worked out. And I think part of it's like, I hadn't yet crossed over to doing the big, big shows at the Castro or with the San Francisco Film Society. I was still, like, you know, doing shows at midnight. And I think Diane Baker wasn't going to come out at midnight to do a show.
I would come out at midnight anytime.
Well, we've got to do one.
Diane Baker, just so you know, it's Straight Jacket. She was supposed to end that movie.
Mm.
But Joan saw her do the take, and she was so good. And Joan's like, no, I'm the star. I'm going to end this film. And that's with her, you know, hugging on the you know, the column at the house, you know.
Yes.
Doing her Joan Crawford.
Oh, that's amazing.
But do you know how Dad started doing gimmicks?
No.
Oh, do tell.
You don't know?
I don't believe so.
Oh, fun. Kyle, do you know?
I think I know, but I think it would be better if you told the story.
Okay. So, Dad was a director for Columbia. And he was just, you know, directing films that Harry Cohen told him to direct. Like, he directed 100 films. And then he decided to go out on his own, and he got this book, and he got the rights to it. And it was eventually called Niqab. And it was done in, I think, 10 days for under $100,000. And he was in bed and he's like, holy shit, I've mortgaged the house. I've done this film. I'm on my own now. And nobody's going to come to the theater. Nobody's going to come. So he broke out in a sweat. He goes, what am I going to do? And then he bolted up in bed, my mom said, and he said, I'm going to insure everybody against death by fright. So just in case somebody dies during the movie, their beneficiary will get cash. So he went to Lloyd's of London in England. He got this weird policy that actually is a real policy, and he insured moviegoers against death by fright. Now, everybody went to the movies, and they went a couple times just because they wanted to see people drop dead. But that's how it all started. And then once he did that, it continued.
Well, and with that in mind, so from the beginning of the insurance policy, William Castle then created this grand tradition of gimmicks, Percepto, Emergo. So for every for every life insurance policy or flying skeleton, do you have a favorite gimmick in his oeuvre? Was there one that you're like, that stands heads above in terms of what he did?
Well, I have two things to say. I think the ghost viewer and ghost remover was pretty fun. I mean, it's so cool because who's not going to want to see the ghost? But it was a fun thing to be able to do. And it was kind of a creative thing at the time. It was like, so this is for 13 ghosts. And this is, he created a ghost viewer and ghost remover. So for those who were too afraid to see the ghost, you could put up this red cellophane so you wouldn't see the ghost. But if you wanted to see the ghost, you could drop it down and look through the blue cellophane. And you could see these really cool ghosts. And I sort of thought that was sort of a fun gimmick. I also did love the fright break. So if you're too afraid to like see the end of the movie, the best part, you could go out and get your money, but you had to stand in the coward's corner. Kind of like that. But, and of course, the buzzer. You're making me pick the buzzer on this under the seat. You got your butt buzzed. I mean, one that he didn't use, I never got to use, I think is the best.
Well, now we have to know.
Really? I'm going to use it.
That's fair
Kyle's
enough.
Or Kyle's going to use it. or Peaches is going to use it.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, I'd be so honored. I mean, you know, I was sitting here listening to everything you're saying, and I'm thinking about, like, you know, yes, your father inspired me so much for Midnight Mass, but also I have this haunted attraction coming up, and I'm like, oh yeah, we're using a motor to vibrate this crate that the audience is standing in, you know, like we're doing, and I'm like, oh, you know, he continues to inspire me. Like all these ideas that you're talking about have actually, many of them have been incorporated into this like show that I'm working on. So yeah.
Well, I love that so much. And I think life is better with a gimmick, and I just applaud you for like seeing that and going with it. And I just hope, Peaches, that you just keep on having fun and, you know, doing all this wonderful experiences.
Well, thank you. And I mean, speaking of 13 ghosts and also the way that your father's legacy has continued to inspire so many of us, you as well, Terry, and perhaps Kyle, I believe, you know, you were in the documentary, like you are also keeping William Castle's legacy alive. You've actually remade movies of his. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that experience and how you're continuing to keep the flame on the torch lit.
Well, the reason that I do so much about and for Dad is because I love him so much. I mean, he really was such a great guy. And I lost him very, you know, very early. He died very young. But I think I want to, you know, I want to, for me, it's probably pretty personal. I want to keep him alive. And then also to see the fans, like, even, you know, you guys who know who Dad is, I mean, that Dad would be blown away. He would be at your house having dinner right now. He'd be like, oh, so tell me what you like about it. Like, tell me, what should I do next? I mean, he would be like picking your brains. Like, what was bad? What was good? Like, what could I change? You have any new ideas? You know, he was, and I just, you know, I wanted to, you know, keep that alive. And I'm passing the torch of filmmaking to Kyle. So he's getting into the horror genre with his wonderful girlfriend, and they're starting a horror line themselves. And I know you're going to be interviewing Chelsea for this, Stardust.
Mm-hmm.
And Kyle actually introduced me to Chelsea.
Oh. So, Kyle, tell us about your, so you've got the filmmaking gene, and you're going to be making films, would you say, inspired by your grandfather, or, you know,
without revealing too much, you know, I think we're working on a lot of projects inspired by some of Grandpa's stuff that he's been working on. There are some, Mom just recently moved about a year and a half ago. So we did, in the middle of this whole move, you know, we found all of these manuscripts and all these notes that my grandfather had taken. So we're taking ideas from that and making them into new sort of compelling, properties. And, you know, I think, you know, horror right now is so big and it's so popular. But it really is missing gimmicks and it's really missing the fun. And that's sort of what we're trying to bring. And, you know, I love my grandfather so much. I didn't get a chance to meet him, but, you know, through his fans and through Mom and, you know, everybody who he was close to, I, you know, don't feel like I didn't get an opportunity to meet him. And I feel like he's with me every day. And anytime I'm walking around and I, you know, get a whiff of a cigar and smell some smoke, you know, I immediately think about him and my mind starts racing with ideas. So, you know, nothing that we can announce just yet, but some pretty exciting stuff coming up soon.
That's my son.
Oh.
That's my mom.
Well, I love to hear that William Castle, who was already so prolific, left behind all of these things that still are yet to be uncovered. There's still more William Castle to be found. And is that the goal then, to take some of these seeds of ideas that he left behind and not only preserve what William Castle has left us, but bring new William Castle to this generation?
Totally, exactly. And I mean, some of them are even more than seeds. Like this, the gimmick that Mom is talking about is a pretty fleshed out and complex gimmick. So, you know, I think that this stuff needs to be shared with people. I think Grandpa would want it to be shared. And we need to, you know, we need to bring it and let everybody have that experience. And I think that's what the world needs right now after this hellish year and a half that we've all sort of been through. You know, it's time for a little bit of fun. It's time for us to all get back together. Yeah, it's time for us to be, you know, scared and eating popcorn and not terrified that, you know, we're all going to die, everybody.
What about a prequel to House on Haunted Hill?
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Can I just tell you right now, and I know that many of the listeners are feeling the same way, the news that you both just delivered is so exciting and wonderful. Like, I'm like getting goosebumps because you ask this question of people that you have on a show like ours, and you hope that you get an answer like that, but this is just beyond. And I think that, like, knowing that you have stuff in the works and just knowing that there's material that the ideas that you might be able to realize of his that he wasn't able to, and hearing from you, Terry, that it would mean the world to him to know how much we appreciate his work, it's so heartwarming and also very sad in a way, because, you know, it is a tragic thing when someone, you know, passes before they get to enjoy the legacy they've created. And this happens to many of the world's greatest artists and contributors to culture.
It breaks my heart.
It is like a cliched tragedy that some of the greatest contributors often had no idea, right? But I think that your dad, and I certainly hope that, you know, I get to meet him someday in the future and get to, you know, let him know how much he meant to me. But just to hear that, like, right now, exhibition is so desperately in need of this boost that you're talking about. And I think that your grandfather's ingenuity is exactly what the industry is lacking right now. And with COVID and the pandemic, and as someone who's made my entire living in cinemas, I've made a feature film about cinemas. I did a the way I always describe it is I did a William Castle style roadshow, you know, across the country with the help of Mark Cuban and some other people. You know, this was my attempt to, like, bring gimmicks back. But it's hard. Right now is the time, because everyone's been locked up in their houses, you know, in their places for 18 months, 19 months. Like, getting people to see that the experience of enjoying something together, screaming together.
The shared experience.
Yes, laughing together. It's healing. As cheesy as it sounds, there's healing nature to that.
Screaming together.
Yes.
I mean, fun screaming together. Not screaming because, you know, everybody's sick and dying, but fun screaming, like a, you know, a roller coaster ride. And then laughing. That's the whole thing. You scream and then you laugh.
It's actually therapeutic. And you know, with the haunted attraction, what I see all the time is an actor jumps out, a group of people scream, and you actually see the release. You know, that it's almost like their entire body loosens up. They just laugh and laugh and laugh. You know, they're hugging on each other. And it's, well, it's like that moment in The Tingler. It's almost like a therapy session when Vincent Price is like telling the audience, you know, you've got to scream. And when
scream,
we
scream for your life,
scream for your life. And when we do it at midnight mass, it's like people aren't screaming just because they're being told to. It is a release. You know, there's something therapeutic about it. So I look forward to everything you're working on. And, you know, just
Kyle and I will come up and be in the audience whenever you want us to.
Well, I think eventually Michael and I would like to start doing Midnight Mass shows in theaters again, and we would love to have you as a special guest for, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, the,
and maybe Michael can get him. You guys can do one down in LA.
Yeah.
We'll come up to San Francisco.
Both.
That's home for us too, but
I'll get my butt buzzed anywhere.
I was saying, why not both?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, one thing I want to ask, and I was going to ask it earlier when we were talking about our favorite William Castle movies, but part of the discussion today has been about how he felt like an underdog. And cult movies in of themselves are underdogs. And so, of course, when we talk about William Castle's legacy, there are the ones that have become part of the discussion, House on Haunted Hill, The Tingler. But he had such a large body of work, such a prolific oeuvre. I'm wondering if within that body of work, there is a film of his that in of itself is an underdog that you love, that you wish more people had seen.
He did a film with Marcel Marceau called Shanks. And the first half of that movie is just pure poetry. It's really lovely. The second half is almost impossible to watch. It's really bad because it really, the studio sort of tried to bring it back to more of a William Castle film, and Dad was really actually trying to speak to the end of his life in a way. And it actually is pure poetry, and it's, and Marcel is just so lovely and brilliant in it. But that's the underdog. But the underdog part of Dad is the reason I think he was such a great guy, because he never forgot that he was an underdog. So he was a champion of underdogs, not just in cinema. I'm talking, you know, people everywhere. You know, he could get into any theater, but he would make me stand in line with him, because that's what people do. You stand in line to go to the movie theater. You know, he told me, this is actually kind of funny. He told me I could marry anybody I wanted to marry, a black man, an orange man, a woman, it didn't matter, as long as I didn't marry an actor. That was his advice. I think he knew I liked to eat too much. I think that's the underdog part of it, is I think part of his story, because he was orphaned. He tried everything. He appreciated. He didn't see, you know, he didn't see color. He didn't understand. I think that's why people gravitated toward him. He was a good, compassionate, and he was also incredibly charismatic. I think that helped. But it's interesting because Rosemary's Baby, which was his huge A film, and, you know, he found that book and he made my mother spend the night reading the book. And the next day we mortgaged that house. And then, you know, he wasn't able to direct it because they found Roman Polanski, who Dad actually loved and thought he was so talented. I was about 13 at the time, so I'm not sure how, you know, healthy that was. No, I'm kidding.
Right.
But, you know, that film really killed him.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Kyle, did you ever get any devils for any gifts?
I did not. Growing up, the devil was forbidden in our house.
In our Jewish household.
Like any, in our Jewish household. Any sort of devil iconography, anything, none of that was allowed in the house. It was all forbidden, stemming from Rosemary's Baby.
Verboten.
Because of the stories from what Mom told.
So these are stories from the set or stories around the making of the movie?
And my dad.
Uh-huh.
Being sick.
Oh,
and
I see.
Church, as you talked to being part, you were in a Catholic school, the Catholic Church writing him endless letters saying he's going to rot in hell. He's going to go to hell. He, you know, and dad was, you know, he didn't believe in organized religion. He was born Jewish, but he did not believe in organized religion. He thought all paths lead to the same place. And he was incredibly spiritual. And it really terrified him. I mean, it was like, oh, holy shit, what did I unleash on this world? And then he got really sick, and ultimately he died not that long, I mean, years after, but he never gained footing again. And he could never take his success and make A films, which he called A films, which he thought by his peers was what they wanted. I just find that all very sad.
It is so sad. So it's funny, right when you were bringing up Rosemary's Baby, that's where my mind was going. And I was thinking about it in a different way, thinking about what you had talked about and saying, well, at least he had that big commercial success, right? Like, it's a critically acclaimed film. It's considered a classic, you know, today. And certainly in the genre world, but even beyond the genre world, it's such a brilliant classic film that he created, he brought into this world with Polanski, of course. But the fact that had was a negative experience, it's interesting because at that time, the way the world reacted to that film, and then also I've been lucky enough to get to work with Linda Blair and hear the horror stories, I mean, real true horror stories around what her life was like after The Exorcist came out. We forget that at that time, people were so deeply in belief of this stuff and so deeply afraid of it that people on the streets around the world would spit on her. They would smack her. Her mother did her best to protect her, but like it was a real nightmare for Linda. And in many ways, Linda is this wonderful, generous, amazing person who's dedicated her life to rescuing animals. And I think she identifies best with animals because they don't judge her. And when I think about this part of her life, it's this thing where she has to spend her life now saying, I'm not the devil. You know, it's really...
She was exercised anyway.
She was exercised, yes. But exactly. I think I hadn't thought about how Rosemary's Baby might have had a similar impact culturally.
Well, if you ever talk to her again, tell her I saw her film with my dad
okay. In
Westwood, and my father loved it so much, thought she was brilliant, thought she was... He just loved it so much, and so did I. I went to the bathroom and thought the toilet was possessed, but I loved it. It was the best.
Absolutely. But yeah, that is really too bad that people, you know, just couldn't separate fact from fiction.
My father had a cousin whose wife and the cousin stopped talking to him. I'm just like, you know, you leashed the devil out.
What? How nutty.
And then I just recently saw the film at Paramount. They had restored it, and I went to see a screening, and it is really, really scary. I mean, the scary thing is not the devil. The scary thing is the Faustian deal that was made. Like, I want successful. I'll give you my first child. I mean, to anybody, you know, not just the devil.
Yeah.
You know? So. Oh.
Well, and it's a real shame that he didn't get the lens of time to see the growth. Because, you know, what you're saying, how the immediacy of that movie and the reaction to that movie really affected him. But... As the discussion has grown, and as we look back through the lens of horror cinema and horror fandom, we now can look at point A to point B to point C and how all of these things influenced each other, and to know that he was striving in his mind to make that A picture, when in fact, these A pictures, so-called, would never exist without William Castle to begin with, is truly... the power of his legacy, and I only wish that he could have seen that.
And I think that the lesson in this too is for all of us is, you know, judge your success outside of the lens of Hollywood.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I didn't do that, I would think of myself as one big failure. because I feel everything I do is outside of Hollywood in terms of, you know, appealing to people who want that weirder experience. They want to be a little bit sillier. They want to, you know, come together and have fun and not take everything, you know, so seriously. And not everything should come down to the, you know, the bottom line. Unfortunately, it does, but, you know.
Right, but it's the trickle down, isn't it? When it takes the outsider to make the thing for the insiders to look at it and say, we want to make the thing too, and we're going to borrow that from you. And then it's the lens of history to say, well, you wouldn't have Death to Come, Sir. You wouldn't have this thing or that thing without the work of the people who made it first. And modern horror is nothing without William Castle. So.
Oh, that's so sweet. You guys are wonderful.
It's absolutely true. And for all of you who listen to the show and you know who are fans of John Waters, absolutely, you must know that Odorama, it came. it's not even a subtle stealing. It's a direct, you know, homage to William Castle.
Yeah,
and so many other things. And yeah, we're just so thrilled that you were able to be our guest today. And I have to say that you can't see them in my apartment, but two of my most, I'm not a collector anymore because as a cult movie fan, it's too addictive, you know? So I've decided to stop collecting, but there are a few things that I hang on to. So I do have a bunch of these 35 millimeter trailers of your father's films because back when we would book these midnight movies, they would send you the trailers and never ask for them back. They never recollected the trailers. So
perfect.
We would, you know, so if you ever need them for any reason, I have a bunch of trailers that are for the, you know, for the 35 millimeter, not that anyone uses it anymore. And the other thing that I have framed in my house is an original one sheet from Straight Jacket and an original one sheet from Homicidal. So those are like,
oh, that's great.
Yeah. Two things that I just love so much because, you know, they're from, you know, they hung in some cinema when the movie actually played there, you know.
Michael and Kyle's bedroom, he has my dad's House on Haunted Hill one sheet.
Oh, amazing.
Oh, wow.
It's really fun when I bring my, you know, my girlfriend over and we're sleeping in the bed and she turns and she looks and she sees, you know, House on Haunted Hill. It's pretty funny.
Well, I don't have an original one sheet to House on Haunted Hill, but I do have the reproduction we had made for my movie All About Evil, which takes place in a movie theater. And Natasha Lyonne's character is this filmmaker who's inspired by your father, and she's killing people and passing them off as movies. And all of his posters are in her office. So
I love it. So
what they did was, you know, movie magic. They took these prints, these new prints, and then they stained them with tea bags and folded them up and, you know, made them look vintage. So they actually look old, but they're not the real deal. They're fakes.
That's awesome.
The most fun thing that I found was my dad's old Rolodex.
Oh, wow. Gosh, who's in that? I mean, do you have Joan Crawford's number?
Oh, my God.
Number?
You know, Joan Crawford's in there. It's like Crenshaw 2, 43, 82, you know. Diane Baker. I mean, you name it. Vincent Price. It's like the craziest thing. Nate Nails. You know, that is Michael Ledelli.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, it's just a funny thing to look through because it's like Cary Grant.
I bet. Like,
okay.
That's
the Rolodex to have. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. I actually have it in my living room. I think it's pretty cool.
That is so cool.
That's amazing.
Well, Terry and Kyle, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, we are so thrilled. It's such an honor. And I hope we can do this again. And I hope we can do, like, I honestly would love to, you know, talk about maybe doing like a William Castle film festival or a William Castle something together in the future, you know, when we can get back to, you know, better producing live events.
Yeah,
that would be so much fun because there's really nothing like
that'd be wonderful
films in a theater and having the gimmicks. That would be amazing. And you guys are fabulous movie buffs, and I love it.
Thank you. And if you ever need help coming up with gimmicks or executing them, you know who to call.
Thank you both so very much. Truly.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All I can say is wow. okay? Michael, I know that, you know, for you and I, when we realized that we were going to be speaking to William Castle's daughter, Terry Castle, and her son, Kyle, you and I were just completely tickled because we get to speak to some of the people who, you know, appear in front of the camera, which is awesome. And definitely those are the people with the biggest followings online, etc. But Terry Castle, you know, first of all, she has that name. Secondly, she's actually a daughter who's carrying the torch for her father and producing remakes of his movies and continually keeping his name out there. She's a phenomenal and important figure in the horror and cult movie world. And the fact that she's a trailblazing woman in the genre world is incredible. Wasn't that amazing?
It truly was. And I agree with everything that you're saying because, you know, to listen to her stories of just growing up on her dad's sets, to go and meet Joan Crawford on that 45 degree set, or to have dinner at Vincent Price's house, those stories are enough to last a lifetime. But that Terry has looked at her dad's legacy and said, let's keep this going, that through Dark Castle, she produced those remakes of House on Haunted Hill and 13 Ghosts, and with Kyle is now looking ahead to keep these stories going and find and develop some of William Castle's undeveloped stories so that his voice and his legacy continues. It's also her legacy. And it's just so cool to see her out there keeping the fright alive.
Absolutely. And, you know, it thrills me to no end to know that the way I met Terry Castle was actually through John Waters, as you know. So
yes.
I actually, you know, I don't ask John for much, I don't think. Although maybe he sees it a different way. I don't know. But
although
I did,
John, if you're listening, please email the list of things that Peaches has asked you.
But I mean, I feel like there are these special requests, and you know, I knew that he was friends with Terry, of course, and I didn't have a way to necessarily get directly in touch with Terry, so I asked John if he would put us in touch, and I love that John said, I hate it when people give out my phone number or my, you know, email address. So why don't we do this? You send a note to Terry and I'll forward it. And of course I'm like, yeah, that's amazing. You mean, you know, she's going to get an email from John Waters saying, here's my friend Peaches, who'd like to have you on her podcast, which is how that all worked out. And, it was just fabulous. But the reason I like knew that Terry, might say yes is because, well, you know, I have my name Google alerted, as you do. you know, over the years, I have been incredibly flattered to see that Terry has mentioned me more than once in media as someone who is keeping the torch of her father's legacy alive. And that, I mean, my God, that means the world to me. And now we have this connection with her, this direct connect. And I can't believe that she invited you over for dinner. Like, if you don't do that, you're an idiot.
Oh, yeah, of course, obviously. Did that happen on the air, or was that an after-the-air thing?
Maybe it didn't. Well, just so everyone knows, Michael, because he lives in Los Angeles, where Terry lives, got an invite to go over to her castle. So I was immediately green. And basically, I think what might happen is if I find out about this dinner plan, I might just fly down there and show up with you. Who knows?
Something tells me that would not be a problem.
I think. Well, I don't think she realizes how often I'm actually in Los Angeles. So I'll obnoxiously keep her abreast of my, you know, plans. But yeah, that was just so amazing, and I loved meeting Kyle. You know, imagine how cool it would be. It's very, very sad that Kyle, of course, was born after 1977, and that's when William Castle died so prematurely. I mean, so young, and so Kyle, as the grandson, never met his grandfather. But how cool to grow up discovering that your grandfather is William Castle. I mean, I just love it.
I loved his story about going to the horror convention and making that realization that his grandfather was this person who truly influenced the genre because of the nudie cards that he was given. I mean, like, what a great way to discover your grandfather's legacy, you know.
Yes.
Not not watching it on TV, not, you know, seeing the poster, which I'm sure he had, but like being handed these pseudo pornographic painted cards. That to me is a one of a kind moment.
Okay, so I have to tell you, secretly, I was actually kind of judging that fan because I get the sense that Kyle was young when that happened.
Totally.
And yeah, and I also have to say that as fandom goes, let's see, I didn't want to criticize the fan in front of them because, you know, that's kind of, I think that would be maybe kind of gauche. But I wanted to say, look, I get it. If this were, you know, if your grandfather were Russ Meyer, sure. Like, that makes total sense. But your grandfather's William Castle. Like, this doesn't add up to me. Why is he making nudie, you know, postcards of, like, freaking Joan Crawford, you know, in straitjacket? Like, sure, you know, a Russ Meyer, you know, fan doing that makes sense. But don't you think it's a little hilarious? Like, where did the nudity come in?
Yeah, that would be like someone giving your niece or nephew nudie cards of Lady Bear. Like, you'd...
Or worse, Shrek Lena. Scarred for life. Okay, well, that was just such a thrill. And what a special moment for both of us. But as you and I have talked about already so much, we've been greatly influenced by William Castle and his films. But we wanted to bring on another filmmaker, a dear friend of yours, who I was so thrilled to also meet, you know, meeting these new friends, especially because I just loved her Satanic Panic movie so much. And I think you could better intro her than I can, but she clearly has been greatly influenced by William Castle.
Yes, of course, the filmmaker in question that Peaches is referencing is the director of Satanic Panic, as well as All That We Destroy, which you can watch now on Hulu. And her name is Chelsea Stardust, and Chelsea's a very, very dear friend of mine. She's a filmmaker here in Los Angeles who is quite connected to the world of horror. She worked at Blumhouse. She has produced and directed a musical slasher stage play. She really is someone who understands the ceremony of horror, and that truly is an indicator of how William Castle has influenced her. And one of the things I've known about Chelsea our entire friendship is how very much she loves William Castle and his work and how it's sort of part of her horror DNA. So when this episode was coming together, it was a no-brainer to me that we give her a call so she could come and join us and tell us all about that. And luckily, she's going to do so right now. Welcome back, everybody. Of course, you cannot have a cult without the community that makes it up. And we are joined this week not only by an avowed William Castle superfan, but an iconic filmmaker in her own right. You know her for such movies as All That We Destroy and Satanic Panic. Please welcome to the show, Chelsea Stardust.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, Chelsea.
Oh my God, absolutely. So glad you could be here.
I am honored.
Well, I think that the obvious place to start here is, when did you first discover William Castle?
I have been like a horror film fan since I can remember. And both of my parents are cinephiles. So I grew up all around movies. Halloween is very near and dear to me and my parents as well. They would have an epic Halloween party every year at our farm in the Midwest. And in preparation of spooky season, my dad was always showing me his favorite movies, which Universal Monster movies and Alien, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when I was younger, there was only so many I could watch as a young child. And one of them that he showed me was House on Haunted Hill. And I fell in love with it. It terrified me. I was really scared when I saw it the first time because there's one specific scare in the movie where Mrs. Slades comes out and, you know, you jump, you know, she comes out of the darkness and she's a housekeeper and scares everyone. But that movie. I just absolutely loved it and developed my love of Vincent Price. And then as sort of I got older, I started seeking out William Castle's movies, and because I loved that one. And so led to The Tingler and 13 Ghosts and 13 Frightened Girls and Straitjacket, et cetera, et cetera. So, but that's sort of what kicked it off. And he was just, House on Haunted Hill was just so influential to me as a filmmaker. And I sort of saw that movie and I was like, oh, I want to make movies like that. Like, this movie seems so fun to make. And I want to do that. So House on Haunted Hill is sort of where it all started.
Oh, that's so great. And I think for so many of us, William Castle, as well as Vincent Price, were such a great gateway into the world of spookiness. And it transcended, you know, just being a horror movie. You know, going and seeing a William Castle movie, not that I ever went when I was a kid to the movies, because I'm not that old, Michael. but I definitely watched them on TV. And there's this sense of my love of haunted attractions and carnival and theme parks. That there's this sort of elevated sense of a William Castle film actually incorporating carnival into the experience. So I think like the jump scare you described, it feels like being on a dark ride. Like some of his films really feel like being on a dark ride, and they have the gimmicks and all the creative fun of a sort of a roller coaster experience. And I think for a kid especially, it really captures an imagination. So I love that you fell in love with his films. I did too. And I it's funny, Michael, we haven't really discussed yet with William Castle what the first experience was with him as far as movies go. I know mine was really being introduced to him through Shock Value, where I met so many filmmakers that I wanted to know more about through John Waters' first book, Russ Meyer and William Castle, Herschel Gordon Lewis. I've talked about it a lot in this podcast. But as far as what movie I saw first, I'm not sure. Do you know, Michael, what the first William Castle film was you saw?
I would say that it was probably either House on Haunted Hill or 13 Ghosts, because these were the kind of movies that Robert Osborne used to host on Turner Classic Movies. And you know I'm a sucker for a hosted, curated horror experience on cable. And I used to watch all of those during the October months. Fairly early on, I saw one of those, but which one it was is kind of, I'm not sure, because at the time I wasn't keyed into, you know, just the majesty of the person behind them yet. Like, I know I saw one of these movies early, and then later I got to discover just who is behind the circus, if you will.
Yeah, I think bringing that up in terms of like seeing them on, you know, someone hosting, I think I saw House on Haunted Hill because of, so where I'm from, they had a late night program called Big Chuck and Little John, and they were hosts of, and they'd interrupt the movies, sort of. They came after Goulardi. Chuck and Big Chuck and Little John had worked for Goulardi, so kind of carried on that tradition after Ernie Anderson stopped doing it. And I actually saw it on there in October when they were doing all their horror movies, The Brain That Wouldn't Die and things like that. And that's how I first saw it. And of course, I'm in love with them and their programming. But that's sort of how I saw it, because of these sort of horror hosts. So I share that too.
I have to ask, Chelsea, being a filmmaker who's also inspired by William Castle, one of the things that I love the most about filmmaking or event producing, you know, writing, is actually marketing. And I think partly it's because I was always obsessed with, especially with regard to people like William Castle, creativity and marketing, you know. And I think William Castle, especially those one sheets, the posters, the trailers he did, obviously the gimmicks. And I have to say, as a fan of your films, I really love your posters and your marketing. So do you think there's a connection between... And how much of a hand do you have in the sort of the marketing, you know, creation? Because some filmmakers are hands-on and some are hands-off.
So because I'm still, I guess, quote unquote, like new in the game of feature directing, I've been able to consult on those things, but ultimately the distributor is the one who's like giving the final say. However, the things I've been sent, I've been able to like give notes on, and sort of I can kind of say what I want it to kind of be. And then they're like, okay, we're going to go talk to the higher ups and then see what we can figure out. They've always been, both for All That We Destroy and Satanic Panic, they've been very supportive and have taken my notes and, you know, when I've, you know, given them here and there. But I have them hanging in my home. And I also love the, I get fan posters sent to me too, which is the best ever, which is so fun. But yeah, anytime I, you know, am given the opportunity to give notes and my thoughts on it, I take it. So far it has been going well in the department. Hopefully it stays that way. But yeah, that's something that's so fascinating is the gimmicks that he was able to do in theaters. And I was like, anytime a movie, you know, sort of dares to do that is pretty amazing. And obviously with Hitchcock did some of that with like, don't give away the ending. But, you know, Castle specifically, you know, using Percepto, like who, it's like putting something in chairs in a movie theater for the Tingler is just so genius and just heightening that sort of audience experience, but without interrupting the experience of the movie, I guess I'll say. I just think it's so genius, so ahead of its time. I just think he was I think he was a great director, but I also think he was a great businessman and a great producer, like how he was, he's cared so much about the audience and their reactions to everything. And I think one of my favorite things about him as a director is how much he was making these dark movies, but he himself had so much heart and seemed like such a warm, like wonderful person, and just really wanted the audience to like love his movies. And that just warms my heart so much. I love how much he cares.
Well, credit where credit's due. Audience, if you had the good fortune to attend the premiere of Satanic Panic, which I luckily did, in the lobby of the Egyptian Theater, Chelsea had set up an altar where we could all put on our satanic robes and get our photo taken as if we were part of the coven before going into the movie. And I feel like that was a very William Castle-esque gimmick to get us set up into the mood of your film. And so I have to ask, with gimmicks in mind, obviously, as Peach has pointed out, we are all sort of the generation that we didn't really get the opportunity to see these movies in theaters unless there's been a revival screening. But of the gimmicks that you know about, is there one that you wish that you could have seen in person or that you hold particularly fond in your heart?
Well, I love the you know, the idea of like the skeleton coming down for House on Huntingdale and Murgo. But I think one of the ones I find, I guess I'll say the most interesting, is the Mr. Sardonicus, the punishment poll, and giving, like, the audience could give a thumbs up. Like, there'd be a break in, like, I think it was the last 15 minutes of the movie. The audience could give a thumbs up or thumbs down to see whether Mr. Sardonicus, like, lives or dies. And 90% of the, like, 100% of the time, they voted thumbs down. So they played because audience loves to punish right. Their characters. And so there was always like a rumor that existed, like, was an alternate ending shot? Did anyone ever see it? Was it ever was one ever released? And I think that's like unknown, or maybe there wasn't and they just like kind of pretended that there was. But I just always thought that was really the choose your own adventure sort of choice that didn't really exist before, that idea didn't exist before. So again, way ahead of its time, and would have loved to seen that like alternate ending, you know, like did that exist? Like what would it be? You know?
Yeah, that actually, it's a really good question. I love that answer. And we haven't really talked about that gimmick yet, but it's such a great gimmick. And it made me think of something that I hadn't thought of in a while, which is, okay, I want to ask you both, like, who is doing this now, and how does William Castle's legacy live on, and can we think of examples of films, especially, you know, where the theatrical The exhibition part of the film had a gimmick tied to it that specifically drew people to, you know, to seats, you know, butts in seats. And I was thinking about the 80s film Clue, and when Clue was released, and if you were a kid from the 80s, you remember that depending on what advertisement was in your market or what color Clue card they used to market the film in its showtimes in the newspaper, that indicated what ending it was going to have. And they actually shot multiple endings. So if you watch Clue now, you know, they show you all the endings in succession. But when it was released theatrically, you know, this cinema, you know, if you went to Baltimore, where I grew up, you could see this ending. And if you went to Annapolis, you could see this ending. And if you went to DC, you could see this ending. I mean, that to me feels like a very William Castle, you know, marketing gimmick, like right out of his, you know, playbook. And then and so I've been thinking in the last few days, because we're immersed in the world of William Castle, like, I don't know that I can think of a movie recently. I've thought of, The Human Centipede, because I feel like with The Human Centipede, they smartly booked these midnight screenings for a first run and basically created a campaign around how vile the film was. You know, they really, that's what they sold you, was you are going to be disgusted and you need to see this, and we're not even allowed to show this movie before midnight. And I would say, okay, that to me is very William Castle, but I can't, can you think of anything more recent?
I mean, Clue's the perfect example, but in terms of recent things, I mean, maybe similar is not that recent, but Blair Witch, and what Blair Witch yes. did with you know, these this is a true story, and of course that was like yes. such early internet days, like people actually believed that Heather and Josh, like, they disappeared, and like that was so genius. I think that would be very hard to do today, but that was so incredible. Very William Castle in terms of a gimmick. Paranormal Activity, what they built, the mm-hmm. building up of like showing people's reactions in the seats, like getting, I remember watching the trailer a bunch of times because I was like, this is fascinating.
You're totally right. Those are two great examples, actually. Especially, I think, the Blair Witch is phenomenal, because you're right. I forget now that they were the ones who presented a found footage film as if it were real, yeah. you know, yeah. and it worked, you know, that's amazing. Yeah.
It totally worked. And in terms of like, I think the only thing that is an actual, like, while you're watching the movie interaction thing is Rocky Horror is the only thing I can kind of think of, is like, in terms of sometimes there are people like acting on the stage, but also the audience directly interacting with the movie. And that's kind of the only other one in theaters that I can really think of, but
if you come to Midnight Mass,
well,
because basically that's all I did, was try to turn every single movie I ever screened into a William Castle experience.
Yes,
that's what I was going to say. I mean, obviously, you know, not just because you're sitting here, Peaches, but the All About Evil Tour de Fierce was a grand example of doing this gimmick sort of roadshow, and we talked about that a little bit with Terry. Obviously, John Waters doing Odorama is an homage to
yes.
what William Castle did. I mean, you look at sort of like the barf bags for Mark of the Devil or Blood Feast that Herschel Gordon Lewis passed out, but I think it's fewer and farther between in the era of streaming and the era of mainstream hold on theaters, because gimmicks aren't necessarily economically viable. And so you have to look to the indie market. And one person that I can kind of think of that has taken that gimmick in the recent years and made it work is a indie filmmaker that Chelsea and I both know and is also a fellow Baltimore resident, Peaches, Chris LaMartina. He did a movie called WNUF Halloween Special. And what's really particularly brilliant is, much like Blair Witch, it's presented as if it's a Halloween special taped off of late 80s television. But beyond them, just
I watched it and I did not know. So tell your friend. I stumbled upon it and I was like, and I was mad at myself for not. I was like, is it? I couldn't. The attention to detail is so well done, and it's so he really nails that thing that's so hard to do, which is to really present something that is authentic and what he, you know, without giving a tell, which is to make it too entertaining. And I don't mean that in a shady way. What I mean is it was fascinating in a very truly vintage way.
Really a tip of the hat of just the sheer evil genius of Chris is not only did they curate the movie in that way, but they've released records as if these are records that were lost at the time from, you know, that they'll do like whole print ads that were supposed to be from the 80s, and they never put anything in there that reveals that it's part of a modern movie. And that in its own way is exploiting, and I say that with exploitation film love in mind, the modern mediums of discovery. And I think that's what makes it work. He just put it out there and it's like, yeah, it's true. And we know it's not true because we know Chris. But it's like, he continues like, here's another record that we found that was made in 1984 or whatever. And you're just like, sure. And you want to surrender to that fantasy. And that's a great gimmick to sell a horror film, honestly.
Oh, well, you know, we have to, this is a total aside, but Michael, so Chelsea, just so you know, I'm from Maryland, and if this guy is also from Baltimore, Michael, we have to ask him if he's seen Blood Circus, because Blood Circus, which came out of Baltimore, also very inspired by William Castle. Also, they with Blood Circus screenings, they gave out scream bags so that you could scream into a bag. I don't know, they were called Hallow bags or something, but you know, like this guy who made this movie. Who just so happens to be the father of my childhood best friend. It's a long story. His name is Santo Gold. I would love to know if your friend knows this story, because it would be so up his alley, because, oh God, I can't even, the infomercials this guy, Santo Gold, had. I mean, your friend would love this stuff. I have to know. We have to have him on a show. But he's not our guest today. Chelsea is.
Chelsea is.
Yes, yes.
But I love Chris Lamartina too.
Okay, good.
I think, you know, something that like resonated so much with something, speaking of like thinking about WNUF, is like there's a commitment level there that the actors are in. And I see that in all of William Castle's movies. And granted, like William Castle has done like 67 some movies, everything from noir to mystery to adventures and westerns and romances. And most people just know him for the like big 12 horror movies that he did. But his actors were always committed. And that's something that like you guys actually touched upon a little bit in the Desperate Living episode you did about like the reason you buy all the characters in John Waters movies, David Lynch movies, Cronenberg movies, William Castle movies, is the actors are there 100% committed to this world that's created around them. And that's why these movies work. And I think that's why we end up like quoting lines from them and dressing up as them for Halloween. And I have a very close friend that was telling me like, you know, 2 years ago, they dressed up as Frederick and Annabelle Lauren from House on Haunted Hill, which is one of my favorite parts of House on Haunted Hill is Vincent Price and Carol Omart's chemistry. And basically like joking about trying to kill each other. Arsenic on the rocks. It's just, and there's something about it that's like, it's very fucked up, but also something about it's very, maybe this just says a lot about me, is very kind of sexy too. It's hard to explain. But their dynamic is so fat. And of course, like he's trying to play her, she's trying to like play him and trying to, you know, make him think, oh no, darling, I would never do that, but is really scheming, as is he. And so that I just love so much. And I cite that, I have actually cited this movie as relationship horror, specifically because of the two of them, which really just makes the movie sing. And of course, Vincent. And I love that he's, you know, there's multiple actors he's worked with. Like he's, you know, Vincent Price, they work together on House on Haunted Hill and The Tingler, and Joan Crawford working on both Straight Jacket and I Saw What You Did, I Know Who You Are. So you know, actors don't necessarily come back to work with people if they're not a huge fan of them. And like even like him working with Joan Crawford, reading about that in his autobiography is so fascinating in that she was like, she was in it for the promotion. She's ready to work. She wanted to work, do the work for him. And it's just really fascinating. And I think there's something very magical about that. And he's putting the fun into the frights. And also, you know, you can tell how he's full of heart and just so passionate about what he's doing and loving these movies. And I don't even know who today, like thinking about, you know, because a lot of people are like, oh, this producer is the modern day such and such. Like a lot of people talk about Jason Blum right. as being the modern day, like Roger Corman. But William Castle was doing sort of these lower budget films, but they were for studios. So he was doing stuff for Universal. He's doing stuff for Sony, you know, and also independent places too. But I don't know who's sort of doing that. I don't know if, Michael, if you can think of anyone who's doing that sort of thing is like the direct line to the, well, things are also so different now, but was so committed to is like what I love and just seemed like an all around, like, I just really wish I could have gotten the chance to meet him and to talk to him. And,
yeah.
you know, he was only 63 when he passed away. And when I got to meet Terry and her son, Kyle, so Terry is William Castle's daughter, who I know is also on this episode, I was so starstruck, I guess I'll say. And I just, a friend reached out and was like, hey, I know these people. I feel like you would get along really well with them. And I'm like, oh no, I know who they are. Like, and she invited me over to her house. And I just told her sort of how much her father's work meant to me as a person and as a filmmaker. And, you know, House on Haunted Hill is one of my comfort movies and I watch it all the time. And, all of his movies, you can just put them on at any time because they're all like 65 minutes. Like,
yes.
They're so accessible. And so, of course, I came into that the first time I met her, like, real hot. Like, I was like, listen, I want to do this and I want to do that and I want to do a biopic and I want to do it. And I was like, on fire. She was such a good sport. And I was just like, I love all of this. You're like, I can't express. I like want to give back. It's like, I want to give back. Like, that love that I felt, I like want to be able to give that back and like properly express. Share that love with the world. And so she was awesome. She was so accommodating of my geeking out. And then of course we've stayed in touch since then, and scheming schemes and things like that. So sorry, I just went on a total ramble about, you can tell I'm real passionate about William Castle.
Oh, it's completely wonderful. And we love that sort of enthusiasm and passion. And I love everything that you articulated because it reminded me, one, I think you're right that there isn't that modern day William Castle, that William Castle really is one of a kind. I can think of directors where I would say, okay, there's this thing or that thing, but the whole package, no. And part of what I love that you articulated so well is this reminder that his movies were dismissed. And that was part of his struggle, right? Like, he never got the respect from his peers, his industry, that he deserved. However, it is undeniable that Vincent Price and Joan Crawford are perhaps two of the most talented people ever to appear on celluloid because of the fact that they're just so timeless and their movies will play forever. And it's undeniable. You've got Vincent Price, Joan Crawford. We're talking household names. The fact that young people would be able to identify their image to this day. And you're right. They show up in these films and they deliver A-plus performances. And the movies are fun. And they're you know, and they're effective. And it just made me pissed when I was sitting here thinking about, you know, the fact that he never really got the credit he deserved, except from those respected actors who came back, you know, to do multiple movies. So I love that, at least, that, you know, you point out they didn't have to go back, you know, but they did.
Well, what's interesting too, Peaches, is when you say that he was dismissed, and we talked about that with Terry and Kyle as well, but the more I think about it is, yes, he was, by an industry that was quite happy to borrow from him and steal ideas wholesale. One of the things we talked about with Terry and Kyle is that William Castle sort of was one of the few directors who was out front of his movies. You'd see him in trailers, you'd see him on the posters. And in our conversation with them, we talked about how maybe the only other person who did that was Hitchcock. But one thing that we didn't get a chance to talk with them about is that Psycho doesn't exist without William Castle, because Alfred Hitchcock saw William Castle movies and thought, now's the time that I can make this. So even a filmmaker that he got compared to by a lot of critics in a lesser than capacity borrowed from him to make his greatest hit. So without William Castle, we don't have a whole generation of genre film, including Hitchcock's work.
That's a really good point. Okay, I know that we're running out of time, but I had a question for you, Chelsea, that I did not ask Terry. I actually forgot, although maybe I wasn't sure, but I did forget. So I'm wondering if you've ever seen Matinee, and what you think of that movie, and, you know, how much of it is, you know, William Castle.
Mant, yes. Mant in Matinee. Absolutely. And I'm also a big Joe Dante fan as well. So, yes, I did. I did see Matinee. I'm a big fan of Matinee. But I also, I'm so surprised. Like, that's kind of the closest thing, even though they're not saying it's William Castle, that the closest thing we've got to a sort of biopic, kind of, sort of, not really. But that's kind of the closest thing we've got to it. And so I love the, you know, idea behind that. But part of me is like, can we let the world, because not everybody knows who that's supposed to be about. And so it's like, again, credit where credit's due. Once again, not getting the credit, just like, you know, everyone forget, like a lot of people forget that he produced Rosemary's Baby. So it's like he found that book. So a lot of people forget that. And so it's again, talking about like giving William Castle the credit he deserves. And that's why it's so important to keep talking about him and keep talking about his movies. And, you know, a lot of them will be playing this Halloween season. And for anyone who's like, you know, interested in him, I cannot recommend his autobiography enough. And it's called, I have it right here like a nerd, Step Right Up. I'm going to scare the pants off America. And if you're a film nerd, like, or just a lover of movies, it is, his story is so fascinating. Like, you'll read it in a day. It's just, you can't get enough. And one thing I wanted to read real quick before we wrap up is at the end of the book, there's an epilogue and he has his obituary in here that it literally says, "Ladies and gentlemen, step right up. Meet the very dead William Castle. Shocking, astonishing, extraordinary. Never been done before. Perhaps my best gimmick ever. I died on May 31st, 1977 at my home in Beverly Hills, California. But don't be too sad, because I'm back from the grave and I'm going to scare the pants off a whole new generation of kids. Don't believe me? Dare you to visit me at williamcastle.com."
Wow.
I mean, come on, like, how cool is it? Like, it's kind of amazing. And so it's like such a kind of, there's this optimism and warmth that kind of comes from that. But I just think it's so, you know, if you're into learning more about him or his journey, or just like reading about Hollywood in general and how it was working in the 50s and 60s and 70s, like check this book out. I cannot recommend it enough. And
I can't, I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read it. But I'm so excited. I knew it existed, but I'm so excited to be reminded. And I'm going to read it, Chelsea. I'm really actually looking forward to it. Oh, I'm actually excited because it's like, well, I haven't read that, and I know I'm gonna love it. So I'm gonna enjoy that. And I'm just gonna put it out there because as Peaches Christ, I tend to predict things. And Chelsea, I think that, you know, something's in the stars. It's in the dust, the stardust, regarding you and Terry and some sort of project. I don't know, you know, what, but it's just so clear that you have this wonderful passion, and I hope that it comes to fruition someday, and that you get to, I don't know what, I mean, people, the listeners might think that I know something. I don't know anything. I'm just sort of intuiting that Chelsea needs to make a William Castle either movie or series or something. So, you know, let's put it out in the universe. You know, we'll live the secret. And I just love your passion for him. I love that you want people to remember him and learn about him. And you know, it's how I feel a lot of times about, legendary drag queens. And it's nice to have these, you know, legendary filmmakers that not everyone knows about. And it, to feel so passionate about spreading the good word. So thank you for doing that.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we'll see what happens. Fingers crossed. Yeah. And we'll see what happens. And maybe it'll be so fun you'll have to take a fright break.
Absolutely. And, you know, Chelsea, thank you for coming to talk to us on Midnight Mass. I feel like we could talk about William Castle for hours. But
we have.
Yeah.
Michael and I have.
Yeah. But the real gimmick is we're just getting started. Thank you so much, Chelsea.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Chelsea Stardust. You know, Peaches, I really love Chelsea's enthusiasm for William Castle. She obviously is deeply influenced by his work. I love that she read us that passage from the end of his book. One thing that I was really thinking about, and we talked with Chelsea after we turned the mics off, is she referenced seeing his movies on Big Chuck and Little John and Goulardi. And for people who don't know, those people were regional horror hosts in the Cleveland area. And for a while, there was a market where all of the network affiliates had their own local hosts, like Chili Billy in Pittsburgh, or Morgus the Magnificent in New Orleans, and all of these various places. And a lot of those people would show William Castle's movies. And it was kind of this epiphany to me that a lot of people discovered William Castle via horror hosts, whether it was on those regional shows or through Elvira or Joe Bob Briggs or Rhonda Shear. But William Castle himself was kind of a horror host because he was out in front of the movies. He was your friend on the poster or in the trailer that was like, come and join me for this wild night. And I think that's part of our connection to him, because as you can speak to in your affinity for Elvira, it's like having that friend who walks you through this spooky world. And William Castle did that too.
He really was this kind of ironic presence in a way, because where he differs so much from the rest of the horror hosts that you've mentioned, he did not take on a spooky persona. He did not attempt to be creepy or spooky. You know, I think Hitchcock was that naturally in many ways. And all of these other horror hosts, you know, put on costumes and, you know, were in spooky sets and environments. And, you know, William Castle was almost like Norman Rockwell style American dad, you know. And I love that Terry basically backed up like, oh, yeah, that's who he was. But he loved having fun. He loved scaring people. He loved the showmanship of it all. And I think he's an anomaly in many ways because of that sort of the persona is kind of incongruous to, you know, what he was actually presenting, which are these, you know, really spooky tales. Yeah, I have to say, and here's where I'm going to shamelessly plug my own projects. This whole episode really has shown a light on how much I've been influenced. You know, I don't sit around going like, who influenced me the most, you know? And I often don't really bring up William Castle in interviews, and I realized that is crazy. William Castle, I mean, in so many ways is responsible for my whole sort of idea of what Midnight Mass, the stage show, would be. And additionally, I'm seeing it right now as I build Terror Vault's new show, The Immortal Reckoning. You know, this haunted attraction I'm doing, it is storytelling. Like, a lot of people, I think, don't get that, you know, it's not a haunted maze alone. It's actually immersive theater, and it's a story. It's a fully realized story, which is why it costs a little more than a haunted maze. But there are all these gags and gimmicks. You know, if you come and you wear a red glow necklace, that means you're opting in for interactivity, which indicates to the actors as you go through the show that you can be touched, you can be fed something, you can be isolated for a one-on-one scene. This year, we are electrocuting people. We're locking them in coffins. I mean, does it get any more William Castle than that? And I don't know. It's just, I'm so glad that we're doing this episode right now, because as I move into opening Terror Vault, literally in a few weeks, and by the time this episode comes out, it'll be like, I think, a week away. It's just lovely to know that, like, in my own little way in San Francisco at the San Francisco Mint Building, I'm keeping the torch of William Castle alive. And if you want to come see Terror Vault's new show, The Immortal Reckoning, or enjoy the Fang Bang Bar experience, we're doing a vampire bar, and see sort of all this William Castle influence, you can go to terrorvault.com and grab your tickets. And I will say that the podcast has not been used much yet by Michael and I for shameless promotions such as this, but it will be. It will continue to be. So watch out.
Well, yeah, I mean, the truth about Peaches and I both is we always have things going on, and frankly, we want you to know about it. But, you know, Peaches, what's really interesting is how you said that when you think of your influences, you don't always mention William Castle in interviews, but through this conversation, it became very clear that he's sort of a foundation of those mm-hmm. influences. And one of the things that we talked about throughout the conversation, and a point that I brought up a few times as well, is his impact on the people who impacted us. So there's a through line. And even mm-hmm. if you look at the episodes of Midnight Mass that have come out prior to this one, starting all the way at the beginning, there's an element of the showmanship of what Doris Fish and Philip Ford did in Making Vegas in Space mm-hmm. that obviously was inspired by William Castle. Brian De Palma was influenced by Hitchcock, who we know was influenced by William Castle. You know, we talk about William Castle with Lloyd Kaufman on the Troma episode. Yes. We know Bob Zemeckis yeah. was influenced by William Castle. John Waters' favorite filmmaker is William Castle. That accounts for a good portion of all of the episodes that we've done up until this point. And so,
basically all of them.
He is, yeah. He is our influence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us tonight at church, or today, this morning, because this mass was such a great way to worship at the altar of William Castle. And I think that Michael and I realize this is one of many, like so many of our subjects, you know, one episode is not going to be enough. I think what we should do, I'm going to propose that we do some deeper dives into individual films. I would love to do a Straitjacket episode someday, or Homicidal, or House on Haunted Hill, or, you know, any of them, really. But that's where we're launching this love affair on our podcast with William Castle. It's not the end. This isn't the end. It's not over. So thank you for listening, as always. And because you're listening, you should know you are all children of the Podcore now.
Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.